Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. Joining me this week at the roundtable is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio, State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Sarah.
Thanks for having me.
Natalie Faume, State House reporter for NBC4. Welcome back.
Always great to be here.
And Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for Hana News Service. Welcome back.
Good morning to all of you, and happy birthday to my son.
Aw, happy birthday. So, recreational marijuana goes on sale tomorrow. The Division of Cannabis Control has cleared the first round of dispensaries to open since Ohio voted to legalize cannabis for those 21 and older in November. The list includes several stores in Columbus, like Bloom and Terrasana. Sarah, do you expect to see long lines tomorrow morning?
I think that's what dispensaries are preparing for. I know I talked to one owner of a chain of dispensaries a while back, and he said kind of part of his preparation was talking to dispensaries in other states about what they experienced. And, you know, you saw so much excitement even when issue 2 passed last year that people were kind of hanging out around dispensaries, seeing what was up. So I think the expectation is that the dispensaries that are open, because it's not going to be all of the existing medical dispensaries, it's just going to be the ones that have gotten their dual licenses so far, I think they're expecting long lines, and a lot of them have beefed up staff.
Noah, do we know about how many dispensaries are open across the state?
Yeah, just before we came on the air here, the Ohio Department of Commerce Division of Cannabis Control put out their initial announcement. 98 certificates of operation have been granted, authorizing sales to start tomorrow. I think Commerce said, you know, call ahead, because just because they got the certificate doesn't mean they're necessarily ready to open their doors. So that's good advice.
I would venture to say, though, a lot of them are prepared to open their doors, particularly because there was some initial reporting. Representative Jamie Callender, who has been heavily involved in marijuana policy, he was thinking that sales could start as soon as June. So I know I talked to one dispensary on Friday, Terrasana in Columbus, and they were like, you know, we thought it might be sooner than August. So I think a lot of them will be prepared.
And it has been a long time coming. I mean, it was legalized at the start of December. And the big problem was that the governor said and several lawmakers, well, it's legal, but Ohioans don't have any place to legally buy it because it's still illegal to go, say, to Michigan, buy it and drive it over the border back to
Ohio. That's a federal
crime,
actually.
Yes, exactly. And licenses didn't really have to start going out until the start of September, September 7th, I believe. So kind of a bit ahead of schedule by about a month, but also still very long time coming here. Ohioans have waited several months after its legalization.
No, it kind of surprised me, though, because I think it's unusual to see a government program launch early.
Yeah, well, you know, the person in charge of cannabis control has talked about how having an operating medical program for years helped them get the processes started, and they're replicating a lot of their processes. Everyone in the supply chain is getting a new license to sell recreational, kind of mimics their medical license, and that's been part of the process. All of the cultivators and processors had to get their licenses before the dispensaries could get theirs.
Do the dispensaries feel confident that they have enough supply to meet this early demand?
I think that it's going to depend on the dispensary. So you've got some dispensaries that have, you know, national footprints. It may be, you know, easier to rely on other places. But I know I've talked to dispensaries that are concerned if there's huge demand, some of your products that you want, some specific products may be out of stock. But, you know, I think folks at the dispensaries may try to say, hey, try this product instead. But there are definitely, I think, concerns about supply. And I think the biggest place you're going to see it is not necessarily places being totally sold out of marijuana, like total run on the stores, but that prices are going to be higher than, you know, maybe other states that have had programs that have been around longer because the program is so new.
I also think it's worth reminding people that you should bring cash because a lot of these stores are not going to take credit or debit cards. They can't, actually, for the most part.
Yeah, that's my understanding. And I know in other states, folks who, you know, maybe put down a card, how you do it is you literally put down a card and then they'll take out cash and hand you the cash and then you pay in cash. So it's kind of another reason that because marijuana is being legalized recreationally state by state by state, there are kind of these weird kinks in the process because it's not federally legal.
There's been marijuana banking legislation discussed for years, but like many things in Congress, has not gone anywhere.
Yeah, it's probably, I think they were even talking about it a decade ago when I was working in Oregon and they were legalizing cannabis. So maybe one day. Let's move on and talk about redistricting. Governor Mike DeWine wants voters to reject the Citizens Not Politicians amendment on this November's ballot, but he also opposes the way we currently draw lines for our state house and congressional maps.
That's exactly right. He, so he has said for months now that he does not think that having the current system works very well. He wouldn't be opposed to a citizen-led commission, but he says this one, this specific proposal that will be on the ballot in November, he says it's not a good proposal. On its surface, it may seem like a good proposal, but he talks a lot of, about proportionality, saying, you know, if we follow that too much, we're going to end up with the worst gerrymandered maps Ohio's ever seen, and then voters are going to want to change this again. It's really interesting that he doesn't like the current system, doesn't like the proposal, but then has put, I mean, is not calling, for example, the GA back to put a competing proposal on the ballot. That was one of his big qualms last November with last November's issue one, which had to do with reproductive rights as well. Voters didn't have something to choose between. That's why this passed. So it'll be interesting to see if it's kind of the same logic after this November, if this does pass.
I want to play a quick cut from the governor's press conference last week.
If this ballot proposal were to be adopted, Ohio would actually end up with a system that compels map drawers to produce gerrymandered districts. In fact, Ohio would have gerrymandering in the extreme. Further, I'm afraid that if this amendment passes in a relatively short time, after the voters see the results, see the districts that have been produced, voters would once again demand change and would be even more disillusioned with the whole mess.
You know, Noah, DeWine says we need to stop this constant rewriting of our state's constitution, and I mean, he's not wrong. This will be the fifth time that we've voted on map making in 20 years.
It's true. A couple of them failed. I think the last one that failed was about a dozen years ago. Then we did General Assembly redistricting and congressional redistricting in 2015 and 2018, or may I have those backwards. But the process has been revised a lot. And then this most recent time, we had litigation that made us redraw two cycles in a row. Now, if this passes, we will redraw again. Who's to say there couldn't be more litigation? All these terms that are going to go into the Ohio Constitution are maybe taken to court and will be defined in detail by justices of the Ohio Supreme Court. Federal courts could weigh in. Somebody could make the argument that, well, this is in conflict with the Voting Rights Act or so, you know, even if it passes, it's not a done deal.
and just from the perspective of like recent ballot issues, this is not the first ballot issue in the last year for the governor and the majority lawmakers to come out against. And their coming out against, their opposition campaign obviously has not swayed voters. Abortion passed, marijuana passed. So I do question, you know, the kind of sway that DeWine has in coming out as the face of the opposition of something like this.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is also going to be different than last year, and that last year was an off year, whereas this year is a presidential election. So the ability of anybody to cut through the noise of an incredibly expensive presidential race and an incredibly expensive Ohio U.S. Senate race to get their message out on redistricting reform is going to be difficult.
Yeah, I think they've reserved some television ads, but I mean, they're not reserving 50, 60, 70 million like they are for the U.S. Senate race.
But campaign finance reports did show that they brought in about $24 million from January 1st to July 25th.
Nothing to sneeze at. That's good.
Yeah. And most of that money is going towards ad buy. So they're spending millions and millions of dollars trying to get two Ohioans on the airwaves. But like Noah said, and like you said, it's going to be difficult because Ohioans are going to be inundated with ads, campaign ads for candidates as well.
And there's an extra piece here with that foreign money proposal that passed the Ohio House. Obviously, there's litigation with that. Passed the Ohio House and the Ohio Senate.
Yeah.
Was signed by the governor, I should say. But, you know, that's kind of hanging in the balance. And, you know, groups, progressive groups that conservatives have really focused on, like the 1630 Fund, they have been contributing to Citizens Not Politicians.
Yeah, and speaking of citizens, not politicians, former Supreme Court Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor is leading that campaign. And she said what the governor had to say about proportionality in gerrymandering was, quote, insulting to everyone in Ohio.
Yeah, she even offered to say, oh, well, we'll sit down with the governor and explain it to him because it doesn't seem as if he understands it. There was a little edge to that comment.
Yeah. I will say, I think what's going to be really important, particularly in this crowded 2024 election cycle, may actually end up being what appears on the ballot. So if voters haven't really heard about it, and then they get there and they're voting for president, they're voting for Senate, and then they get to this, when are we going to actually write the language that appears on the ballot?
Next Friday?
Next,
right?
Yep, next week, the ballot board will meet. There have been, you know, in the past, it's a Republican-led ballot board, majority Republicans on it. So in the past, especially last year with issue one and issue two in November, there have been some issues about, or the campaigns behind the issues have been like, well, the way they wrote this wasn't fair. This is going to mislead voters. So it will be interesting to see what the language looks like. I mean, not to mention redistricting is a pretty complicated issue. Not everyone at face value is going to really know what redistricting is and what it does and why it's important. So
yeah, I believe with the abortion and reproductive rights issue, it did go to the Ohio Supreme Court, and they did require a small tweak in the language to say that what was originally written was misleading. So that may well happen again.
Who knew the ballot board was going to end up being such a controversial place in Ohio politics?
They really, I remember probably whenever casinos were legalized, 2010 maybe. Oh man, there were a lot of well-paid lawyers in that room arguing over every comma and every word.
I think it just speaks to, too, it's such a process to even, like, make the ballot. I mean, it's not just, like, a random group of people gets together and, like, petitions the government. I mean, there's so many hoops that these organizations go through. They got to raise a lot of money, and there are a bunch of layers of government they have to get through to get the language that they want on the ballot.
Yeah. And if you find redistricting complicated or confusing, you're in luck. Our next season of Untangled is going to unravel its history, how independent commissions work in other states, and honestly, why gerrymandering matters. The first episode drops Monday, August 26th. And a little sneak peek for those listening now, I'm going to tell you about 1842's redistricting. When the Whigs, yes, the party that preceded the Republicans, was so incensed by Democratic redistricting that all of the state senators resigned to deny them a quorum and to stop the maps from being drawn. So we have ugly redistricting now, but we don't have, you know, Democrats quitting en masse to deny a quorum and stop the maps from being drawn bad.
Democrats quitting en masse today would not eliminate the possibility of
That's
a quorum
true.
In the Ohio Senate.
That is also true. So they're in a weaker position than the Whigs were in 1842. We're going to take a quick break, and coming up, we'll get an update on Intel, from job cuts to its massive electricity needs. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, and Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for the Hannah News Service. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance's comments from his Ohio Senate race continue to resurface the election. It's prompted a lot of think pieces and political opinions about a campaign reset for both the president and his vice presidential nominee. Former President Donald Trump defended J.D. while speaking to Black journalists at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention, but he did have a strange answer when asked whether J.D. would be ready for the job of president on day one in light of the assassination attempt.
I've always had great respect for him and for the other candidates, too. But I will say this, and I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president, in terms of the election, does not have any impact. I mean, virtually no impact. You have two or three days where there's a lot of commotion as to who, like you're having it on the Democrat side, who it's going to be. And then that dies down, and it's all about the presidential pick.
So, Noah, I do think he's right that VP picks don't often have impacts on generating votes. But he didn't answer the question about whether J.D. would be ready to be president.
Yeah, it was interesting, although I guess you never really try to predict what former President Trump will say. But I mean, if he wanted to generate some buzz in a competitive state, you know, picking J.D. Vance wasn't the one because he's won by several points the last two elections. And that probably will be the case this time, too. So,
and I mean, obviously, Vance was picked prior to current President Joe Biden exiting the race, which changed things as well. So you have to wonder the calculus that would have happened if exited sooner. You know, you can't go back. But a lot of these things that I think are being reported were well documented in Ohio before Vance rose to the national stage. And it's not the first time former President Trump has made a comment undercutting Vance in a way like that. I mean, years ago, he called him J.P. Mandel, so.
Yeah, and, you know, even J.D. Vance was caught last week during a fundraiser saying that Harris getting into the race and Biden getting out was a sucker punch and that it had changed the calculus of the race. So, I mean, Trump and the RNC and all those folks can't go back and redo it again and decide who they'd pick if Harris was the nominee.
Well, because when Biden was the nominee, Trump and Vance were up against a very dismantled Democratic Party. Some of them didn't want Biden. Some of them wanted Biden. So it was a big mess, essentially. But now that Harris is the pick, it seems as though the Democratic Party is rallying behind her a lot more than they were behind Biden. So that's a lot more powerful now. And I think it will bring out more voters in general across the country. But I guess it always comes down to voter turnout and who exactly does show up. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, she's put up some pretty impressive fundraising numbers. I think it's $300 million in 2 weeks, so nothing to sneeze at. And speaking of the old comments from J.D. Vance, he criticized Simone Biles in the 2021 Tokyo Olympics when she decided to pull out, citing twisties. Back then, he said, "I think it reflects pretty poorly on our sort of therapeutic society that we try to praise people, not for moments of strength, not for moments of heroism, but for their weakest moments." Well, Simone Biles decided to tweet after winning the all-around, "I love my Black job." So the campaign is getting a little shade from Simone Biles, which I find sort of wild that these comments are coming back in such a poignant moment, because I'm like, oh, it's the Olympics. And this is this old reference to the last Olympics. And now it's all circling around the presidential race.
And Trump was also asked about that Black jobs comment as well that he made during the presidential debate against Biden back in June. He was asked about that at the National Association for Black Journalists conference, too. And he didn't really have a good defense for it. He was kind of like, well, any job that you have is a Black job or something along those lines. So it's a comment that I think is still kind of befuddled quite a few people.
Let's move on to who's going to be the next vice presidential nominee. We're on watch. We expect it to come tomorrow, potentially. Kamala Harris is expected to announce her vice presidential pick. It is not going to be someone from Ohio. I can promise you that much. But there is a chance that the pick comes from another Midwestern state or neighboring state that's not quite Midwestern, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I feel like I have to plug here that I grew up in Pittsburgh. I've seen people on Twitter calling Pennsylvania the Midwest and also Kentucky the Midwest. I feel strongly neither of these states are Midwestern. However, I think Josh Shapiro and Andy Beshear, the governors of Pennsylvania and Kentucky, are definitely big contenders. I mean, I saw photos of a Kentucky license plate driving into a meeting with Kamala Harris yesterday. So they are definitely two that have been heavily talked about. And I think you see a lot of governors. I think in Andy Beshear, you see someone who could potentially counter that Appalachian narrative that J.D. Vance brings to the race. But it's definitely another fun Veep stakes that we weren't in for a month ago.
Yeah, governor of Minnesota is on the shortlist. Mark Kelly, senator from Arizona. So I don't know. We'll find out tomorrow, maybe.
No later than tomorrow is the latest reporting I saw.
And, you know, the vice presidential race is sucking up most of the political oxygen lately just because the news keeps coming. But Ohioans have another important decision to make this November, one that could decide which party controls the U.S. Senate come January. The latest fundraising numbers are out, and Senator Sherrod Brown has about $13 million on hand, while Republican challenger Bernie Moreno has about $7 million. And Noah, money matters in a campaign, but when it comes to what is going to be spent on this race, the official campaign cash that I just rattled off, that's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, there are dark money groups aligned with both sides, the caucuses, just issue campaigns. It could be $100 million race easily or more. So what they officially get in their coffers is only the tip of the iceberg, as you say.
And I think things will really probably ramp up after Labor Day thereabout. I know July was kind of a whirlwind, and it seems like all the political news was happening in July, but we're still a while out from the election, and typically things don't ramp up until September. Although Marino's been making stops across Ohio, Sherrod Brown's made a few. What I find really interesting is that neither of them made any appearances, or at least media appearances, at the state fair, which has usually been a big spot for candidates to stop and campaign and meet with voters. So, and I just found that interesting.
Yeah, that is a weird turn of events. I think J.D. Vance, when he was running, didn't he judge like a pulled pork contest or something?
He did, yeah. And even after...
It's one of those strange rites of passage.
After he was elected, too, he came back to the state fair. I remember he did a whole gaggle about August issue one at the state fair last summer. So it's typically a place where candidates, elected officials go and do a lot of media availability, but we didn't see as much this year.
Sarah, the latest polling shows Brown with a 4-point lead over Bernie Moreno, but if you go back a couple of months, that lead was 8 points. So the polls are narrowing. We're now in the margin of error. I assume, safe to say, this is just a toss-up.
Yeah, I think it is a really tight race. I think it's hard to predict. I think, obviously, in more recent years, as reporters, have become more wary of polling, period. I think the fact stands that there will be people in Ohio, I mean, there are going to be people that vote mixed tickets, but there will be people in Ohio who vote for Donald Trump and vote for Sherrod Brown. They are two different sides of the populist coin. I think that Sherrod Brown has said that this is going to be his toughest campaign yet, but I don't think he's dead in the water just because Donald Trump is going to win this state.
He has a history of running ahead of the Democratic ticket, but can he run far enough ahead this year is the big question.
Yeah, I was going to say, no matter who the Democratic nominee was going to be, Brown finds himself in a pretty awkward position because outside of Susan Collins in Maine, voters have universally elected senators whose parties match the candidate they picked for president. So Brown is looking to be the second senator in history to win in a state where the president of the other party won. So those are not good odds. That does not mean that it's impossible. Sometimes the long shot wins, but what I find interesting is Brown recently told CNN that it's not about what political party you are, but whose side you are on. And when it comes to campaigning with Kamala Harris, he's got his own schedule and his own race to focus on.
Yeah, it's really highly anticipated, but it does come at this strange period where I don't think at least in recent history, a presidential election has been so highly anticipated as well. So I hate to keep saying it, but it just comes out to voter turnout and who's actually going to show up to the polls.
And, you know, we're not quite at the 2024 election, so let's talk about 2026. John Husted has $5 million bankrolled for his gubernatorial campaign. That's our current lieutenant governor. He hasn't made an official announcement yet.
He hasn't made an official announcement yet, but he's been kind of telegraphing it. I mean, I believe DeWine Husted for Ohio was sort of reorganized into Husted for Ohio very shortly after Governor DeWine was reelected and reinaugurated. So no one is surprised.
And you see him taking on, I mean, in smaller policy aspects, he takes the face of certain things, I think, especially in the arena of jobs and technology. I mean, he has carved himself out in those ways. And I think DeWine definitely allows him to shine in those areas as much as, I mean, he gives them the platform to do so. So he is the, I think, obvious DeWine choice as a successor.
I think that was part of the deal in 2018 when they got on a ticket together, but who knows? Attorney General Dave Yost is widely expected to run for governor as well. Natalie, do we think we're going to see anybody else in this race?
I think it's likely we might see a few more people in the primary. I mean, again, still a
it's two years out.
Yeah, a lot of things can change. A lot of things can happen between now and then. Ohio politics are hard to predict, but I think the attorney general and the lieutenant governor are both going to put up a good fight, regardless of who else does decide to jump into this race.
Bigger, more difficult question for all of you. What about the Democratic bench? Like, who are the Democrats going to put up in 2026? Because that seems to be the biggest issue that they face in statewide offices.
One of, I think, the main rumors is that minority House Leader Allison Russo might throw her ring into the race. She, of course, has neither confirmed nor denied this rumor. But that's one, I mean, I guess we'll have to see who the new up-and-comers are in the next few years, who rises to prominence within the Ohio Democratic Party in the next few years. But we know last gubernatorial election, Nan Whaley was...
It was 60-40-ish. That was about the split. I mean, that makes anybody with political ambitions take pause.
And the race was called within seconds of the polls closing, too. So
I wouldn't discount Tim Ryan. Mm-hmm. I think Tim Ryan is still out there floating about. I've seen him at events that I've been like, I wonder why Tim Ryan's here. So I wouldn't. I don't know this with any good authority, but I wouldn't discount Tim Ryan.
I mean, he lost by, 6 points to J.D. Vance. Vance ran about 15 points behind the governor. So he gave him more of a run for his money.
Absolutely.
And you typically see your big city mayors at least consider the possibility. Former Cincinnati Mayor John Cranley ran in the primary against Nan Whaley last cycle. There was, when Coleman was in charge in Columbus, he was floated, you know, didn't quite get fully in. But so their names are always in the mix.
We'll have to wait and see. But we have a bunch of bills that are now law and will start to take effect this fall. Sarah, you wrote about them, including one that would number ballot issues from 1 to 500. So that will stop the endless issue one?
Yes. And I think it became a big issue, no puns intended, last year when there was an August election on issue one, and then there was a November election on issue one, and the positions were generally flipped. So folks were saying vote no on issue one in August, yes on issue one in November, and vice versa. And, you know, even that sole fact may confuse some voters. So as the bill stands, it takes effect in sort of in time for this election. So what will happen is the Citizens Not Politicians Amendment is all but guaranteed to be issue one this year. We'll start with issue one this year, and it'll be the last issue one for a very long time.
So then if minimum wage actually ends up qualifying for next year, that could be issue two.
Sure. And it'll just go on from there. And like you said, it ends at issue 500.
Well, that'll I think that actually is a smart idea, because I was like, how many issue ones? We've now had three issue ones in 1 year.
And an interesting anecdote as a journalist, I would notice when I'd look at my analytics, I would see pop-ups from an older issue one when, so like last year when the abortion election was happening, I would see stories about an older issue one pop-up. So the issue on like bail that was from the year before. I really do think it has the potential to confuse voters before they go into the ballot box, because maybe you're preparing based on old information and you get to the ballot box and it's not the issue one you prepared for.
Oh, my goodness. So WOSU reported last week that consumers could be on the hook for some of Intel's massive electric needs. The plant will need about 500 megawatts of electricity, enough to power 500,000 homes, and we could be on the hook for 40% of the cost of extending electrical services. So yay for us.
Yeah, there's something called a reasonable rate consideration that the Public Utilities Commission can approve for economic development purposes, and allows these kind of special circumstances where the company that needs the new electrical station that Intel will need will not have to foot the bill unless they don't meet their obligations under in terms of how much of an investment they make in the facility and how many jobs they create.
So we'll have to wait and see if they meet those. But as long as they meet those, we could all be on the hook for slightly higher electricity bills.
And the issue of energy and bringing our electric bills down, I mean, we hear a lot about this at the State House and how we're on this imminent energy cliff and how in a, you know, 5 to 10 years we might start seeing rolling brownouts and blackouts. So there's a ton of energy legislation at the State House, too, to try and make sure rate increases don't have to happen. But most of those efforts are stalled.
And this is the flip side of courting mega projects. I mean, they bring economic benefits to the state, but when you think about data centers, which are not generally considered to be these mega projects like Intel that are creating a bunch of jobs, you know, AEP has a proposal out right now saying that they want these data centers to have more skin in the game, that they don't, you don't often see AEP coming out and saying, you need to pay us more. And they're singling out a specific customer, these data centers, and saying, you're eating up all this energy, you need more skin in the game. So, I mean, I think everyone's starting to throw ideas out there right now. They're just ideas. Like Natalie said, it's not been like one specific solution to this, but there, I mean, it is the flip side to these big economic projects.
J.P. Blackwood of the Ohio Consumers Council said his group would support the proposed deal. He says consumers' bills are going to go up 50 cents or about 60 cents if this deal is actually approved.
It's a game changer. Creating 3,000 jobs isn't just creating 3,000 jobs. You know, those 3,000 workers have to get their hair cut. They have to buy groceries. They have to, you know, jobs create jobs. And this is great economic development for the region and for the state. And consumers are going to benefit from it.
But on the flip side, Intel just announced plans to cut 15,000 workers as part of a global restructuring. The news came following weak quarterly earnings and dismal stock market showings last week. It says it hasn't disrupted work at the Licking County complex, but still, cutting 15% of your workforce is not insignificant.
They don't have a huge workforce footprint here yet, but, you know, this is the nature of publicly traded companies, and who's to say when they're up and running, you know, 10 years from now, there's not another restructuring where they have to make these kind of decisions.
And I think if you follow, I mean, this has kind of been the trend with Intel. If you follow national news about Intel, they are losing the chip war to other companies like Qualcomm that are performing really well in these spaces. So it is, I mean, Intel as a... Obviously, Intel has an Ohio presence. They have something to prove in Ohio. But as a national company, as a global company, I think it's pretty objective to say they're struggling in a lot of ways.
Coming up, Ohio rolls out digital driver's license. That's when the All Sides Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us this hour is Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, and Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for the HANA News Service. Our phones are quickly becoming the only thing that we need when leaving the house. Apple Wallet can hold your credit card, concert tickets, sport events, and soon it's going to be able to store your Ohio driver's license. Sarah, this is both surprising and not surprising to me. Feels just like another step in the digital transition.
Yeah, I think that there'd been a question, especially among younger generations, about like the last paper copy thing I need to carry with me generally is my license. And I should say, even though Ohio is adding your driver's license to your Apple Wallet, you can now add it. You can't drive without your physical copy still, but it definitely felt like the natural next step.
Yeah, what I find fascinating was Governor DeWine and Lieutenant Governor John Husted went to John Glenn International Airport last week, where they made this announcement and said you will be able to use it to board a plane, right?
Yeah, and I am super excited for that because, you know, when I'm standing in the TSA line, I have to get my ID out and then I have to just like throw it in the bin before I get to the other side. Then I can put it back. It's just a whole process. So I'm excited just to be able to tap my phone for my boarding pass and my ID. My understanding, though, it's not at all Ohio airports yet. So I know, for example, I'm from Northeast Ohio. So like the Canton-Akron Airport, the Cleveland Airport, not quite yet.
It's part of a national pilot program, that TSA part of it. So there are like 20 or 30 airports, I think, nationwide that you can board. And it's about getting the tech at all the airports. So eventually, all of the airports in the U.S. will have this technology. But I think the TSA has information, like if you're flying to like Denver or something and you're curious if you can use it there, the TSA has information about which place or which airports nationwide are taking it.
I believe we're becoming the fifth state, along with Arizona, Colorado, Georgia, and Maryland.
And the cool part about it that I picked up is beyond TSA, Ohio is expanding it to like bars and restaurants and businesses. So like if you buy like a six pack of beer, like a carryout could, that already has maybe the Apple Pay technology, they could have you scan your license if they choose to as well, all in one place.
And although, that might be.
Yeah, so although states have expanded it to this TSA thing, Ohio is one of fewer states that has expanded this opportunity to bars and restaurants and different businesses.
That's going to be wild. It also will be nice because, you know, sometimes you have to wait at the checkout for them to get the person who can come and check your ID, and it'll be nice just to, like, tap again. So really, you'll only need to take your phone to the grocery store or who knows.
Yeah, if they're accepting it, there you go.
It's just kind of, I don't know, it also reminds me again, like, don't lose your phone. Like, dear Lord, don't lose your phone.
Someone made a point, though, that it's almost just also, like, a nice backup.
Yeah.
Like, if you're, it's going to take time to roll out. And I think that's the important thing. Like, I've had conversations with people of all ages about this add-on, and I've heard from people, like, what's the point? Like, I can't drive with it. So, but I think it's going to take time for businesses. I mean, some businesses already have Apple Pay. Some businesses don't have Apple Pay. It's going to take time for this tech to become more ubiquitous. But, like, I think once it gets there, it's going to be really cool.
I think Ohio a few years ago allowed you to start showing your proof of insurance for driving this way digitally.
So Ohio also is rolling out its first ever sales tax holiday. Now, we've had the back to school holiday for years, but this is completely different. It now applies to pretty much anything as long as it's priced at $500 or less. The exemptions are booze and tobacco.
And marijuana.
Well, yes.
And like boats or something. Some random items.
But I'm not sure you could get a boat for under $500.
Yeah, that's fair.
I'm not sure you'd want a boat that cost under $500. But I will say it's been a little bit of a bumpy rollout. Like, I was at a dance competition for my daughter this weekend, and all of the out-of-state vendors were charging sales tax.
Did you fight them on it?
No, I mean, they said, I told the people who are running the competition, and they were like, oh my gosh, we dropped the ball on this. And I guess you have to like reconfigure your credit card machines to not take tax. So it wasn't something they could just switch up. So fun fact, I was going to say this later, but there is a form that you can download from the Department of Taxation's website to request a refund. So, you know, for 30 cents on like donuts, not a huge deal. But, you know, if you're buying $100 dance shoes, maybe you want to fill out the form.
On Depends. The flip side, the businesses that are in Ohio, I mean, Easton, on, I went to Easton on Saturday, and it was feeling like Black Friday-esque. I mean, Easton is already crazed on Saturdays, but there were lines out the door at stores. Stores were open longer hours because of the sales tax holiday. They all, I mean, most stores had signs that said sales tax holiday, no sales tax. And I know even like a local running store is saying if you go over the $500 limit, they'll cover the sales tax. So, you know, businesses love this.
Yeah, the Council of Retail Merchants were the ones who lobbied for several years to get the back to school sales tax holiday in law on the basis that it would generate this kind of extra economic activity and kind of make up for the lost revenue because people are going out, and so they're probably going to go to a restaurant and they're probably going to buy some things that are not exempted. And
like those boats.
Everyone's buying a boat now.
With all that tax savings.
Yeah.
No. One of the interesting questions, you know, Policy Matters Ohio, more of a liberal think tank, progressive think tank, they did not love this idea, saying, calling it a gimmick rather than a giveaway. But, I mean, this was one-time money, right? No, this was one-time money that the legislature had, and they were like, what can we do with it? And they're like, let's do a sales tax holiday.
Yeah, they put about more than $700 million toward this. And originally they mandated a two-week holiday, and the governor used his line item veto power just to strike that two-week language because he was not convinced that $700 and some million would last for a two-week holiday. So he and the County Commissioners Association and some other groups had to get together and huddle, and they came up with the 10-week. And
10-day.
10-day. I'm sorry. Not 10 weeks. 10-day. Nice. Very important distinction. But the back-to-school sales tax holiday actually still exists in law, because this broader one will only be triggered in years when there is at least $60 million in surplus revenue. But if that's not the case, we will still have our first weekend of August back-to-school sales tax holiday in leaner times.
Have you been doing back-to-school shopping?
Not yet.
You should get on it. By the way, Tangier Outlets up north was totally swamped. I had some friends who went up there, and apparently they had like local law enforcement directing traffic because it was such chaos.
Seriously, the Hollister at Easton looked like a bar for kids under 21. Like, the line out of the Hollister was insanity. So I am not surprised. I mean, I think even people who don't have anyone going back to school, i.e. me, are enjoying the lack of sales tax on things.
Oh, for sure. So, Noah, Republican House Speaker Jason Stevens announced new committee assignments and chair appointments. Was there anything notable? This came after he sort of fired, I don't know if fired's the right word, in mass, people who went against other Republicans in the primary.
Yeah, there's been a lot of committee movement in the last few months, and some of this is kind of reverberations of that. There were some House members who gave to primary opponents and after that he took away some chairmanships and then had to shift people around. DJ Swearingen, who's from the North Coast area, ended up with the Health Provider Services chair. Monica Blaisdell is now chair of pensions. She's from Columbiana County, because Adam Matthews shipped over to Public Health Policy Committee when one of those other representatives got taken out of his
seat.
So it's
musical chairs.
Yes, it is a little bit of musical chairs.
And it further highlights that ongoing divide in the Republican House caucus over whether Jason Stevens should be speaker next year or whether it should maybe be the current Senate president, Matt Huffman. The two are probably going to go head to head this December. So a little fire after the election.
So lame duck is usually crazy. Last lame duck, it was like a
It went until like 6 in the morning.
Yes. And
like the final session.
Then the governor's press breakfast was that same morning.
I was exhausted. I slept through it. Yeah. I couldn't do it. I was like, I'm going to bed.
But so, you know, and usually there's like the caucus vote before the new year of who the speaker is going to be. I can imagine this year there's going to be a lot more, you know, it's tough to get a piece of legislation passed through two chambers right now just because of all the Republican infighting. But I think depending on when they hold that speaker's election and who is the presumptive nominee, of course, things can change like we saw this last GA by the time the floor vote's actually taken. I just think it's going to be really interesting to see what legislation passes, what doesn't, you know, kind of the feel and the mood at the State House.
Yeah, and there's still that ongoing fight over who controls the Ohio House campaign cash.
Yeah, I think the latest on that is the 10th District put out a stay of a trial court ruling. So it's a little bit up in the air. It's gone back and forth a couple times recently. It's kind of messy right now.
I haven't covered lame duck yet, but I've been told that it wasn't a good sign that we had a mini lame duck in June. Like, I mean, beyond just getting the capital budget done, that was done at 4 p.m. and yet we were still at the State House until like midnight.
Yeah. Governor Mike DeWine has named attorney and bankruptcy expert Fred Ranzier, I hope I'm saying that correctly, as conservator of the Eastern Gateway Community College. So if you don't remember this story, the college paused enrollment and cut staff, and trustees voted to withdraw their accreditation. So the college is kind of, I don't know, in a messy place, Noah?
Yeah, it's only about 15 years old. During the Strickland administration, they created it, kind of cobbled it together out of some other educational institutions to fill a gap in the community college landscape. But it's had rough going. Its accreditation was on probationary status. The U.S. Department of Education put it on a cash monitoring program, making it harder to get access to financial aid. And it just everything cascaded to the point where they just said, we're not taking any more students, and now we're going to shut down. And this conservator is in place, but within a month, he has to hand things off to a governance authority that's going to be chaired by the state budget director, have a few other people from that region on it to wind things down. And they have negotiated agreements with other institutions for people who are in the middle of their academic careers to hopefully be able to continue their studies somewhere else.
That's got to be such chaos if you're a student enrolled, if you're like a sophomore at Eastern Gateway Community College and your college is essentially dissolving.
The state had to give Eastern Gateway some advances on state operating subsidy throughout this past year because of the restrictions from the federal government that they'd been facing.
So let's have a little bit of good news. As we get close to the end of this hour, the Ohio History Connection has reached a settlement with the Mound Builders Country Club in Newark. That's the golf course that was built on top of the Octagon Earthworks. And it will be accessible to the public starting January 1st. The Octagon is one of 8 locations in the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks, which is Ohio's first and only UNESCO World Heritage Site. So this is a lawsuit that has been going on for like, I think a decade, maybe longer. They've been fighting over how to get the golf course basically off this land so it can become part of the World Heritage Site, because access to it is pretty limited because people are golfing, and I guess you don't want a bunch of tourists walking out on the putting green while people are trying to play it through.
It's not really a good look.
And no.
I think more generally, it definitely shows the struggle, I think, between preservation of land and also commercial interests. You see that in a lot of other places as well. It's definitely always a back and forth, and it's, you know, I definitely think good news to end with on this one.
Publicly accessible January 1st, 2025, too. I mean, that's soon. That's right around the corner. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess they have to dismantle some of the, like, golf infrastructure. I'm not really sure what that's going to look like. But maybe they'll keep the trails, you know, like the golf cart trails. I don't know. But if you are looking for it, it is the Hopewell Ceremonial Earthworks. We actually did a show about it a couple of months ago when it became part of the UNESCO World Heritage Sites. So you can go back and find that at wosu.org/allsides. So, final question for all of you. What is the next twist in politics because we woke up to discover that RFK Jr. left a dead bear and a bicycle in Central Park. And oh my goodness, I could not see that. I have no idea what comes next.
I just wake up most mornings and remind myself that there will be an end to this election season. All election seasons do come to an end.
I don't think this election season, however, will end on November 5th. I think we're going to see a remnants of it for a few weeks or months afterwards. But eventually things have to calm down, right?
I hope so. I hope we don't have a repeat of like January 6th and questions about certification of the election. I'm hoping for clear, decisive victory no matter who wins.
Well, and that brings us all back to like the rhetoric question of all the things we've been hearing about what's going to happen if Trump doesn't win or if the Democratic Party doesn't win. There's just been a lot of crazy high rhetoric around that area.
That was Sarah Donnell. Nope. That was Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Sarah Donaldson, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio. Oop, go ahead.
We're good. It's Monday.
And finally, thank you to Noah Blundo, reporter and editor for the Hanna News Service.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.